Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Moscow to speak with Simon Schuster, who covers Russia for Time magazine, Reuters, and the Associated Press, and has an article at Time, Snowden in Moscow, What Russian Authorities Might Be Doing with the NSA Whistleblower. We will discuss the widely held belief among Russian intelligence sources that since his arrival in Moscow 3 weeks ago, Snowden has been held in a former KGB dacha or country home. Then we'll look into a new poll by Quinnipiac that finds a massive shift in public opinion against government surveillance following the revelations by Edward Snowden. Peter Brown, the assistant director of the Quinnipiac polls, joins us to discuss the change from 2010 when by a 63-25 margin the public felt the government was not doing enough in restricting civil liberties in the name of anti-terrorism, to today where the public feels the government is going too far by a margin of 45-40. Then we'll get an update on Texas Governor Perry and his sister, Mila Perry Jones, who is a lobbyist for United Surgical Partners that run hospitals and surgical centers co-owned by doctors. Her clients are poised to make a windfall when the Texas Senate passes a restrictive anti-abortion bill tomorrow, effectively shutting down the state's abortion clinics and forcing women to go to the much more expensive surgical centers Governor Perry's sister represents. Veteran Texas political reporter James Moore, the author of Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush, joins us to discuss the Perry family's double blessing of piety and profits. Then finally, we will speak with Frederick Rich, the author of a new book just out, Christian Nation, that portrays an America that the religious right envisions, one that would have come to pass had John McCain become president in 2008 and died shortly thereafter, making Sarah Palin president of the United States. We'll discuss this very plausible scenario of a Christian fascist takeover of America that is not unlike what is going, that is now underway in Texas and North Carolina. And joining us now from Moscow is Simon Schuster, who's a reporter based in Moscow. He has covered news out of Russia and the former Soviet Union for Time magazine, Reuters, the Associated Press, the Moscow Times, and has contributed stories to foreign policy. His latest article at Time magazine is Snowden in Moscow, What Russian Authorities Might Be Doing with the NSA Whistleblower. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Schuster.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you, in your article, you state that the accepted wisdom, unofficially acknowledged by most Western and Russian sources, is that Snowden was taken soon after his arrival, if not immediately when he got to Moscow airport, to a secure location run by some arm of the Russian government, presumably the SVR Foreign Intelligence. So that's what your reporting has from talking to former and current intelligence officials in Moscow and abroad.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the people I quote in the article are former Russian intelligence agents. But really, the news that Snowden has not been at the airport, as we've been led to believe, has pretty much been the worst-kept secret in Moscow for a while now. It's just no one has any proof of where he is, actually. But various sources, some of which I can't name or identify, have been saying quite clearly that, yeah, obviously he is not at the airport. He is not sitting, you know, among the fifth-back chairs and eating the cafeteria food that should have been to the airport. He has been taken to a secure location by the Russian government. And basically with that story, I just wanted to find a way to get that out to the public. And I think the most interesting way to do that was by talking to former intelligence officials, intelligence agents who could talk about the way it would have been done in the heyday of the KGB. And little has changed, as it turns out.
Well, but one of the people that you quote is not so much a former, he's certainly well-connected, and that's Vladimir Rubanov, who headed the KGB's analytical directorate from 1991 to 1992, after which he served for 3 years as deputy head of the Russian Security Council. And he is somebody that's closely connected to the SVR, the current incarnation of the KGB. And he's quoted in your article saying, "It is a fool who has the chance to get information and misses it." And that seems to me to be fairly logical, that even if Edward Snowden is a very idealistic and principled whistleblower, he's dealing with some incredibly tough customers, and it's their job to take what he has. It's not a question of him handing over stuff, surely. It's a question of them taking it. Isn't that how the real world works?
Well, that we don't know. But what Rabada was saying, I mean, he was quite coy. He was the official I quoted who was closer than the others that I quoted. And to be specific, there are sort of other sources that I did not name who are closest to the security services. He was quite coy in saying that, you know, to be honest, we have methods of getting this information without, you know, using the force or anything like that, just by sort of talking to him, just by charming him. And I don't know, his position was that we wouldn't need to turn to any kind of extraordinary measures to get him to talk, because he is in fairly dire straits. I mean, he's in need of a friend. He's in need of asylum and political support and diplomatic cover and documents, because his American passport has been annulled. So his point was that, you know, of course, he's carrying very interesting information that the Russian security services would be quite curious about. He was the one who said that it would not be necessary to use any kind of extraordinary means to get that information. That's his opinion. I don't know what the real situation is, and nobody really does. I mean, that's the thing. A lot of this is speculation and conjecture, and even the sources that I do quote in the story, they are talking about what would be done, what could be done from the perspective of the security services.
Again, I'm speaking with Simon Schuster, who is in Moscow. He's a reporter who is based there and has covered news out of Russia and the former Soviet Union for Time magazine, Reuters, the Associated Press, the Moscow Times, and has contributed articles to foreign policy. His latest article at Time magazine is Snowden in Moscow, What Russian Authorities Might Be Doing with the NSA Whistleblower. And you've talked also to Russian hackers, the editor of their hacker magazine, about the assumption. In fact, Glenn Greenwald has confirmed that Edward Snowden encrypted a lot of his files, although it's worth noting that he gave files to, at least as far as we know, to Glenn Greenwald, to The Washington Post, to The Guardian, and to WikiLeaks. So those unencrypted files do exist and are probably vulnerable. But the ones that he encrypted, the questions are whether or not they would be able to get the encryption keys out of him. And I take it that one of the people you talked to, you were just mentioning earlier, they didn't seem to think that they'd have to resort to some of the sophisticated drugs that they used on a former double agent who you also talked with, Oleg Gordievsky, who was subjected to a KGB-developed drug called SP-117, where he says it turned out the lights and made me start talking in a very animated way. And at the end of the day, he wakes up and he doesn't know what he's told them. So I guess, well, what's your understanding of what's possibly going on here with the idea that he has files that are encrypted and therefore has some bargaining leverage, if you will?
I mean, the first point is the one that you made initially, that Snowden is a fairly sophisticated computer expert in his own right. He has hacking experience. So any data that he did take from the National Security Agency, we can fairly safely assume that he encrypted it and likely put it into some kind of a cloud, right? So remotely stored it. So in order to access that information, according to the computer experts and hackers that I talked to in Russia, they say that, yes, there are technologies available quite widely. You or I could purchase them that would encrypt and remotely store data in a way that would make it inaccessible to even the Russian security services if they got their hands on, for example, a laptop that Edward Snowden would be carrying. So, yes, they could physically take the laptop, but they would not be able to access the data on it because of the advanced encryption and data storage technologies that he would have access to. So then they would need Snowden or someone else who has the encryption keys and the passwords to the remote data storage services to hand over basically those passwords. And how do you make someone do that? The insights that I got for the story about that were from, indeed, a former double agent who was called back. He was serving as a spy in the London embassy for the Soviet Union. He was a colonel of the KGB. And he was called back in 1985 by the KGB, who became suspicious that he was a double agent, and they wanted to interrogate him. And he was called to a basically, you know, a regular house, a dacha, a country estate outside of Moscow, and his commanders acted as if nothing at all was wrong. They actually told him that he was about to receive a promotion and an award for his service, and then they gave him a substance. We don't actually know if it was SP-117. All that I say in the article is that is one of the substances that the KGB was using at the time for those purposes, usually in order to test its agents to see if they were possibly lying or becoming disloyal. So essentially you slip this into someone's food or drink and they, become intoxicated. And they start saying things that they wouldn't otherwise. And the next day when the effects of the substance wears off, they don't remember what was said, the nature of the conversations that took place. So this double agent who I talked to, he now lives in the UK. He believes that Snowden, most likely in order to get those encryption keys and passwords, could have been given a substance like that if he did not give them up voluntarily.
Well, of course, Oleg Gordievsky was, the reason he was recalled was that when Aldrich Ames, the American spy, traitor, if you will, in order to establish his bona fides, when he showed up at the Russian embassy, he gave them Gordievsky's name as this incredibly valuable double agent. And Kryuchkov, the head of the KGB's Foreign Intelligence Service at the time, had a dilemma. He wanted to arrest Gordievsky, but he didn't want the trail to go back to Ames because Ames was the most valuable thing they had. So they had to build a case against him without it in any way having Aldrich Ames's fingerprints on it. So that was the dilemma that they had at the time. And of course, he made this dramatic exfiltration from Russia, which
is right. You've clearly done your homework on the history of Russian spies. That's right. It wasn't clear why the KGB did not immediately arrest Gordievsky after he, exposed himself, compromised himself under the influence of this substance that he says he was given, fed. It's not clear why they didn't arrest him. They simply put him under intense surveillance, which he then managed to shake and escape from Russia in the trunk of a British diplomat's car.
But already, the point I was making is that as much as he may have encrypted files with him, and he says he has, he's also given them to Glenn Greenwald, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, and also to WikiLeaks, who seem to be handling his travel arrangements, if you will. And Glenn Greenwald told the Daily Beast that if anything happens to Snowden, the stories will inevitably be published. So that indicates that these files are, in fact, already beyond Snowden's control.
That's a question that came up in the comments to the article today. How do we know that Snowden even has access to the files that he stole from the NSA? We really don't know. I suppose it's possible that he simply entrusted all of them to Glenn Greenwald and Julian Assange and the folks at WikiLeaks and basically came to Russia empty-handed. That's really a matter of conjecture and speculation. Nobody knows for sure. That's possible that happened. But, my feeling is he probably left himself a set of keys as well. So, I'd be really surprised if he did not leave himself access to the files that worked so hard to get and has essentially changed his life and sacrificed his life to reveal to the public.
Well, of course, he himself, Snowden, in a more recent interview with Glenn Greenwald, or at least one that was more recently released, said, "I never gave any information to either Russia or China, and they never took anything from my laptops." But, of course, we haven't heard from Snowden for 3 weeks, and nobody knows where he is. And you're saying that it's the worst kept secret in Moscow, that he's basically in an SVR KGB dacha?
We don't know who's Dutch or where he is. Essentially, for the first week or so, there was pretty much every journalist in town went over to Sheremetyevo Airport. And, I mean, journalists have been prowling the place for weeks now, searching every inch of it. Journalists have been buying tickets to foreign countries, usually Ukraine or Armenia, in order to access the international transit zone, have spent weeks looking for him, questioning everyone from airline officials to airport officials. There is no photograph of him at the airport. There is no sign that he was ever there. So from that and sources that I can identify, saying that, yes, you know, obviously he did not simply, you know, sit down at a cafe and plug in his laptop at the power outlet and, you know, plug in the local airport Wi-Fi connection and continue doing his work. Yes, you know, various sources have been saying that he was taken pretty much immediately to a place where he could be comfortable, that is run by some arm of the Russian government. We don't know which one it is. We don't know which security agency, or, you know, it could even be, actually, Rubanov said this. I didn't get this into the story. He said that actually the security services have facilities in the airport. So, you know, there could be a room or a suite or an apartment in the airport where he would be allowed to kind of relax and take it easy and have access to the internet and various kind of technological things that he might need. But the point is that the idea that he is stranded in the transit zone, as we have been told by the Russian government for 3 weeks now, is pretty silly. He's clearly not sitting around in the transit zone with the other passengers.
Well, indeed, the former KGB top spy in Washington, General Oleg Kalugin, recently told me about that facility they have at the airport and basically said that the KGB completely control that part of the airport. But when I first, when he first got to Moscow, I spoke with Pavel Felgenhauer, defense and intelligence analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta. And I asked him about the possibility. I said, you know, surely the KGB, SVR's job is to get this stuff. That's what they do, as is the case with the Chinese. You know, in fact, in the case of the Chinese, they had every reason to arrest Snowden when he arrived there because he was working for an agency that targets them. So that's just the way the game is played. But Felgenhauer said, no, they said even if they got the material he has with him, they would need time to debrief him, and maybe 2 or 3 weeks. So, and that seems to be the time frame that we're talking about here. Does that make sense to you?
I mean, it depends on the circumstances of you know, what they want and how cooperative he is. If he's not cooperative at all, then it would take years for them to crack the encryption codes, according to the hackers I spoke to in Moscow. It would take years to access that data. You know, so we don't know. At the end, Gordievsky, the double agent who was outed in 1985, or rather outed himself under the influence of this drug, he said that there's 3 weeks is pretty much enough time. So he felt confident that whatever the Russian security services would have wanted to get from Snowden, they would have already had enough time to get it. He said that seems to jibe with the ease with which Vladimir Putin and other government officials are basically saying, all right, you know, you can go now. We don't really need you anymore. You know, as soon as you have a flight out, go ahead and take it. But again, we really don't know what, if anything, the Russian security services were seeking and how easily, if at all, they were able to get it.
Well, just in closing, Simon Schuster, President Obama, of course, has a trip planned to Russia in September, and I imagine that it's highly unlikely that the president would go to Russia if Snowden was still there. So I take it there's no likelihood of him ever seeking asylum. For a while there, he did apply for asylum to Russia along with a lot of other countries. And that was, of course, shortly after Julian Assange said, apropos what you were saying earlier about this place at the airport, the only thing that was ever said about Snowden's whereabouts was by Julian Assange, who said he was in a safe place and he was comfortable. But it's pretty clear, isn't it, that this would be a deal breaker in terms of Obama's trip. And when Putin recently said that Snowden could stay in Russia as long as he didn't keep hurting our American partners, as strange as that may seem coming from my lips. So just in closing, what's your reading on how much this has affected the already somewhat prickly relations between the two countries?
I mean, that's a very interesting point. And I think it's important to remember that the Russian government is a multi-headed beast. I mean, there are some former security officials who hold the opinion that all decisions are made by the security services. Putin is, of course, a former agent of both KGB and its modern incarnation, the FSB. And a lot of people will tell you that all decisions, be they foreign policy, domestic policy, you know, education policy, are in one way or another made by the security services. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. Political considerations, you know, the Kremlin, the presidential administration, they have their say, and they do have an interest in preserving some appearance of this reset in U.S.-Russian relations, some civility in that relationship. So they do not want to treat the Snowden situation in such a way that would really spoil that relationship, that would prevent Obama from visiting Russia in September, as you said. So there's a balance that they're trying to strike between the interests of the various groups, clans, that really control Russia. So, yes, the security services want to get the information that Snowden has. That's you know, pretty obvious. However, the foreign ministry and possibly, you know, various Putin advisors, various people in the presidential administration, they want to be careful about not annoying the United States too much. So they're trying to strike this balance. And so far, they seem to be doing that quite well. I think when we do, and hopefully we do hear eventually from Snowden himself, what he says about his experience in Russia could shed some light on what actually happened and might change our perceptions of Russia's actions when he actually arrived in Moscow in June.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Simon Schuster.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Simon Schuster, who's in Moscow, where he's a reporter based there. He has covered news out of Russia and the former Soviet Union for Time magazine, Reuters, the Associated Press, the Moscow Times, and has contributed stories to foreign policy. His latest article at Time magazine is Snowden in Moscow, What Russian Authorities Might Be Doing with the NSA Whistleblower. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a pollster about a recent poll indicating a massive swing in America against the National Security Agency. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Brown, the Assistant Director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, where he's the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls. He has more than 30 years of experience as a political journalist and editor in Washington, D.C., New England, and Florida. Previously, he was a political reporter for United Press International. He also served as the White House correspondent and then political editor for Scripps Howard News Service in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Brown.
Good evening.
And the Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday, let's start with the definition of Edward Snowden here. And as you know, as being a political reporter, politics are quite tribal and ideological in this country, and most people have their political comfort zones and essentially can't keep two thoughts in their head at the same time. But what's interesting here is, so Edward Snowden, it was viewed as a whistleblower by 55% of the poll respondents, and only 34% of them view him as a traitor.
That's correct. And there's very little difference across gender or political party identification on that. Given the choice, a majority, not a huge majority, but a majority of voters said they more considered Snowden to be a whistleblower than a traitor. Now, what's interesting is that that goes against what most of the political leadership on both sides of the aisle, at least the conventional political aisle, have been very critical of Snowden and indicated they think he's a traitor. So that this is an opinion that voters have come to, clearly not from their political leaders.
Indeed, the political leaders have been extremely silent on what Snowden called for, which was a national debate on how much civil liberties have been infringed upon by the government. And even the president himself talked about the need for a national debate, but it hasn't happened, clearly. But it's possible, though, to, as I mentioned, to have two thoughts in your head at the same time, and that is he could be both a traitor and a whistleblower, right?
Well, certainly that's possible. We asked, which do you consider him more?
I see. Yeah.
And that's the way of trying to get it on a priority basis, what people think.
But the most, the headline here is this tremendous shift that's taken place in public opinion, where you had by a 45 to 40.
Let me explain it to your listeners this way.
Do.
We asked the following question of voters in a sample last week, and we asked the same question 3 years ago, in January of 2010. What concerns you more about the government's anti-terrorism policies, that they have gone too far in restricting the average person's civil liberties, or that they have not gone far enough in adequately protecting the country? In January of 2010, 25% said that things had gone too far in terms of endangering civil liberties. 63% said that they hadn't gone far enough to protect the country. Now, 45% say they've gone too far in terms of civil liberties, a 20-point gain. And 40% say they've not gone far enough, a 23-point drop. This is a very large change in public opinion over the time, and it's obviously not just about the Snowden affair. There are other things that have happened since then. But in a total picture, there's been a pretty large change in public opinion on this issue.
And within the numbers that we've been talking about, my understanding that on the question of whether Snowden's a traitor or a whistleblower, more Republicans considered him a whistleblower than Democrats, and more Democrats considered him a traitor than Republicans, not by a lot. Is that right?
Well, let me look at it. 55% of Republicans, which is the national average, 55% of the Republicans said they considered him a whistleblower, whereas only 49% of Democrats considered him a whistleblower. Independents, interestingly, were the most likely group to consider him a whistleblower, 58%. And there's almost no gender gap. 57% of men, 52% of women said they considered him to be a whistleblower. And that's unusual in itself. I mean, we live in a very sharply divided country.
Right.
In which virtually every issue is marked by sharp partisan division. This is not one of them.
And in terms of whether or not Snowden's a traitor, 38% of Republicans said he was, and 39% of Democrats said he was. So
that's correct. There's statistically no difference.
Right, right.
But 30% of independents, a somewhat smaller number, right. say he's a traitor. But there's no difference between men and women. 34% right. of men and 35% of women say he's a traitor.
Right, but that goes against the normal national security narrative, where the Democrats are soft on terrorists and communists and the Republicans are hard on them, right? I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, I think that gets into... The poll wasn't about that, and right. I'd like to just talk about the poll.
No, I understand, but I'm saying it's obvious that people are thinking in a more nuanced way here.
Clearly, public opinion on this whole issue is nuanced, because despite these questions we just discussed, Quinnipiac also asked some other questions. In other words, we also asked, do you think this program that Snowden disclosed is necessary to keep America safe? A majority, 54%, say yes. On another question, do you support or oppose the federal program in which all phone calls are scanned? You know, 51% say yes, they support it. So Americans understand the need to take care of terrorism threats, but they are somewhat concerned about a loss of civil liberties, much more so than they were, again, 3 years ago.
But just in closing, though, Peter Brown, I guess the big takeaway here is how much our government is out of step with the public opinion, that the public...
Well, you know, government leaders clearly have been critical of Snowden, and many on both sides of the aisle have suggested they think he's a traitor or similar kind of words. But public opinion is public opinion today. And it's worth noting that public opinion changes often, especially on events that are moving events. And this is a moving event. What eventually happens to Snowden, where he winds up, et cetera, you know, we don't know what public opinion will be after that. In other words, this is a story that's still in progress.
It's true, but I think the press coverage probably, I don't know whether, I've certainly haven't done an analysis of it, it's probably been more along the lines of what our politicians are saying, less and less along the lines of what the majority of the public are saying, where they find 55% say that he's a whistleblower and only 34% say he's a traitor.
Well, that, again... Yeah, I get paid to analyze data, not to...
Right. You can leave the pontificating to me. Well, Peter Brown, I thank you so much for joining
us. No problem. Have a good evening.
You too.
Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Brown, who's the Assistant Director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute. And joining us now is James Moore, who's the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-election, and the co-author with Wayne Slater of the best-selling Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and the author of Bush's War for Re-election. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent and has traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976, and his latest book on Texas Governor Rick Perry is Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Moore.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the subtext to the drama that's going on now in Texas, where I believe tomorrow the Texas Senate will pass this restrictive anti-abortion bill, which will effectively shut down the state's abortion clinics and force women to go to the much more expensive surgical centers, which are represented by Governor Perry's sister. She's the biggest lobbyist for United Surgical Partners that run hospitals and surgical centers co-owned by doctors across the state. So this is pretty blatant, isn't it?
Well, you know, there's cause and there's effect. And the question is always, in Texas, is there a connection between the two? And of course, you know, the Perry team would argue that this is strictly coincidental, and that happens to be who her client is. And if the abortion clinics are shut down, then what you're looking at is the fact that most of the women who get abortions at that time are going to end up having to have that procedure performed at an ambulatory surgical center. It's the only qualified facility at that point. And yes, Rick Perry's sister happens to represent the largest organization of those surgical centers. So will they benefit? It sure looks like it. But the people who will suffer the most, as is often the case, will be poor women who have no health insurance
and who have no access to this kind of prenatal procedure, they are the ones who won't have anywhere to go.
But the anti-abortion bill that Perry is selling, and he's, after all, trashed Senator Wendy Davis for the filibuster and for her lifestyle choices, even though most people admire what she has managed with her life. He's appeared before the Right to Life people only recently. So he's wrapped himself in piety, and all of the arguments in the Senate and the House in favor of this abortion bill are entirely wrapped in Christian fundamentalist dogma. So is anybody talking about how there's a double blessing here for the Perry family? They get both piety and profits at the same time?
Yeah, isn't it a wonderful thing when it works out that they get both at the same time? You know, people are aware of her clients, and they're aware of the potential benefit for her clients. And, you know, if you are going to be a lobbyist in the state of Texas, there's nobody better to have for a brother than a guy who is the governor of the state. Yeah, and you can bring it up, but it gets dismissed. Now, there are a lot of animated people here in Austin now that didn't exist, Ian, prior to this event. And in many ways, you've seen what's happened here is a kind of awakening of a sleeping giant. Senator Wendy Davis, who did the filibuster, has launched a statewide bus tour, and she is just drawing huge crowds in the major cities and is firing up women, the Capitol galleries. You know, I was a reporter in that building for 22 years, and I'd never seen the Capitol galleries jammed like they have been over this. And there is a political activism and a progressive hope in this state now that frankly didn't exist before Perry went out and went crazy on this issue.
Well, but isn't the other two that are going crazy are the ones that are the current lieutenant governor, who really apparently is the real power there in that state, and his rival? Haven't they brought this about because they're both trying to be more a Christian than the other in terms of pandering to the Christian right?
Well, what happens in Texas is this is a place where the crazier you are for the primary, the better off you are as a candidate. So when the Tea Party first began to flex its political muscles in this state, people like Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, who was running for governor against Rick Perry, stayed away from them, thought they were crazy. And Perry saw what was happening, and he ran way over to the edge, the right-hand edge of the flat earth, to meet those guys. And he has since embraced every single radical idea that they have. And you know, he proposed in 2010 through the Republican platform to make gay marriage in this state a Class C felony that would have been punishable by 5 to 10 years in prison. And that would have been for anybody who tried to get gay married or any city or county or local official who tried to perform a gay marriage. And so now they all know that that's the way that you get elected and you win a primary. So the lieutenant governor, who, as you said, has most of the power in this state, and the people who are going to run against him, namely Senator Dan Patrick, who makes Rick Perry, by the way, look like a liberal, are trying to get the same attention that Perry got from those groups, especially now that Perry is more or less abdicating his throne for the election in 2014.
And what planet is Perry on? Didn't he notice, and didn't the people in Texas notice his meltdown when he ran in the Republican presidential primary, where he simply was, to the national audience, appallingly dim-witted?
I think that he's hoping for a rebirth, and I think that his deciding not to run is a product of a number of things, but public policy polling, which is a sort of Democratic-leaning poll group here in Texas, found that only 26% of the population thought he should run again. And in fact, Hillary Clinton was out polling him in Texas, and most of the people wanted Senator Ted Cruz, who is in my estimation, crazier and more radical than Rick Perry, wanted Kim to run for president. So I think Perry saw that. And the other thing he saw was that if he's got any chance at running as a viable presidential candidate, he's got to spend some time rebranding himself. And I suspect he's going to join up with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which is a conservative think tank, and try to learn how to hold three items in his head at one time. He will raise money for candidates in the midterm elections and will hope that they will again do the same thing for him in 2016. And he just wants to see if he can take another shot at it. This is a guy who, Ian, frankly, he likes his lifestyle. He likes living in a big mansion. He likes traveling on planes with security and an entourage, and he likes, double dipping on a retirement pension and a salary. And, you know, he's got it great in Texas, but being president's even cooler. So, you know, he's gonna make another run at it.
Well, just in closing, then, Jim Moore, tell me, you mentioned that Ted Cruz is a rising star, and give me the impression that the state is moving so far to the right that you'll need a telescope to see it. And then at the same time, you're talking about an awakening amongst women. You've never seen anything like it. Wendy Davis and all the women are now fired up, and then there may well be a progressive and liberal awakening. So sort that out for us, if you will, just in the last
minute.
Well,
I think what's happened is that the left, the base on the left, has awakened in the way the Tea Party awakened the base on the right. But what's happened is, with the awakening of the left, I think a lot of women have silently resolved that they are not going to vote for a white male who is trying to restrict abortions. And that's turning into a broader base of support. At least that's the early indications, and that's my analysis. Frankly, I think if Wendy Davis chose to run for governor and announce tomorrow, I think she could raise $50 million from around the country in a month. The question is whether she will do it or not and whether she's going to take that opportunity. But she's beginning to feel a huge obligation to keep this kind of thing going.
And Ted Cruz is obviously, even as a freshman, he's thinking of running for president, right?
Yeah, Ted Cruz is going to run, which is a patent absurdity to me, but he's going to do it. And, I mean, we have to bear in mind, this is a man who thinks that President Obama wants to get rid of golf courses in the United States and wants to get rid of paved roads as part of Agenda 21 with the United Nations and has a secret deal to destroy America and doesn't think that there should be any kind of social programs, wants to get rid of the military. This guy is as radical a person has ever been elected the United States government from the state of Texas. And, my friend, that is saying something.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with James Moore, who's the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-election, and the co-author with Wayne Slater of the best-selling Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and the author of Bush's War for Re-election. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent who has traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976, and his latest book on Texas Governor Rick Perry is Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make America Miss George W. Bush. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Christian Nation.
The stars at night are big and bright. Deep in the heart of Texas, the prairie sky is wide and high. Deep in the heart of Texas, the coyotes wail along the trail.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frederick Rich, who's a partner with a law firm based in New York. He has studied at Princeton University, King's College, Cambridge, and the University of Virginia. And his latest book just out is Christian Nation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Rich.
Thank you, Ian.
And your book is in the spirit of Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, and also Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, in as much as it's a warning about something that could happen but hasn't happened. And what you've done is that you've taken the 2008 elections, which were very, very close until the crash happened in 2000. The economy started to crash. Probably had that not happened, it may. There's quite a possibility that McCain might have done better or even won. But you take
absolutely,
and you take the position that McCain wins, and shortly thereafter he has an aneurysm and dies, and then Sarah Palin becomes the president of the United States. So take us from that point.
Well, yeah, that is the counterfactual, Ian. That's what sets the book in motion. And as you say, I chose that that particular counterfactual because it actually could have happened, easily could have happened. And, you know, I use fiction here to try to explore the same topic that you explore and that a number of your guests have explored using nonfiction and journalism. But, you know, for whatever reason, a lot of the great books about the Christian Nation movement and its theocratic tendencies really haven't gotten a lot of traction. So I thought I would try something different and do it as a novel. And you know, it's what they call speculative fiction. But in this case, I didn't have to speculate very much because the Christian right has pretty much told us exactly what it would do if it gained power. So what the book really is about is how it might happen. In other words, a lot of us, I think, aren't as worried, in my view, as much as we should be, because we think somehow the Supreme Court and the Constitution will defend us from these people. And my book shows a path in which actually those defenses break down and they end up gaining power and succeeding in introducing the sort of theocratic state that they dream of.
And, of course, the evidence is manifest because the Christian right has portrayed an America. They've really talked about a theocratic America, America that they envision. The evidence, the whole scenario of what America would be like under them is all very clear. And if you want a kind of preliminary taste of Christian fascism in America, what we were just talking about, it happening down there in Texas and in North Carolina, it's a perfect petri dish for a right-wing takeover of America.
Absolutely, and it's really only the 14th Amendment and the Supreme Court, the federal courts and the Supreme Court, you know, that stand between that avalanche of legislation that is going through the red state legislatures. I'm sure you saw Gary Wills counted up 944 different bills in the first quarter of 2012 dealing with abortion and contraception. We've seen the law recently tabled in North Carolina to establish Christianity as the official religion of that state. We know what the legislative program looks like because it's tabled every day in the red state legislatures. What we don't know is how vulnerable we are to that legislative program taking effect if the federal courts cease to be an effective defense against it.
So in your new novel that's just out, Christian Nation, Frederick Rich, where we have Sarah Palin as president of the United States, McCain and Palin win in 2008. McCain dies shortly thereafter, and then Sarah Palin gets to be Sarah Palin, and she's a firm believer in Armageddon and all of that Christian dogma that you see on Christian television. A lot of secular people find it rather silly. It's one of the biggest sellers is the Left Behind series.
Of course.
But people don't recognize the incredible hubris of people like Sarah Palin, who are insulated in their ignorance and piety. The bottom line is that Sarah Palin and her ilk want our world to end in burning flesh so that their world can begin.
You know, Ian, one of the biggest mistakes that we make on the coasts living in our own, perhaps, liberal bubble is not understanding that when these people say they believe something, they actually believe it. That they mean it, and they do mean it. And it's not just Sarah Palin. You know, the numbers are quite extraordinary. Consistently over the years, roughly 30% of Americans polled say they believe in the literal truth of the entirety of the Bible. They believe in the rapture of the church in their lifetimes. And as you probably know, this group has the highest voting participation rates in the country, about 85%, as opposed to the average, which vacillates somewhere around 50%.
But we've seen replicas of democracy and religion fused together, and that is what we've seen it underway in Turkey under Erdogan, where he's pushing the envelope and turning a democracy into a theocracy. And you've also just seen what happened in Egypt with Morsi. Obviously, it's a pretty murky business, and it looks more and more like Saudi Arabia's behind the coup because they don't want any form of an alternative to their draconian feudal racket that they've got going with Wahhabism and the royal family being able to get all the money from the oil. So they're determined to sabotage any other alternative Islamic model. But what I find extraordinary in the United States is that there, people don't see the similarities between American Christo-fascists and what they easily and often refer to as Islamo-fascists.
Exactly. And the pattern is repeated over and over. And by the way, it's not just Islam that has fundamentalists. I mean, there's a serious fundamentalist, Hindu fundamentalist movement that's affected the political scene in India, and of course the Christian fundamentalists here, and they're remarkably the same. And if you look at how fundamentalism takes a hold, it's the same program over and over. Not only do you have fundamentalists who, like Sarah Palin, claim to speak to and for God, who tell us what God wants, but the other elements of fundamentalism are the same. You know, they're intolerant of non-believers. They have a particular disdain for any kind of intellectual inquiry. We see the Islamic fundamentalists trying to destroy the education system in Nigeria and Afghanistan. And, of course, we see in this country, the homeschooling movement, which is largely evangelical, which seeks to protect children from any kind of a secular education or influence. And the most disturbingly is that this trend, which this kind of fundamentalism is usually kept in a corner until you have conditions of very deep social anxiety and real economic suffering, and that's when it flourishes. And in my book, what happens is that because McCain is elected and there's actually no effort to fix the economy, we see a very, very serious depression in the country, which actually makes the ground particularly fertile for the sort of demagogic message that all fundamentalists offer. So it takes, for this kind of fundamentalism to take hold, it takes some bad luck, but it fundamentally takes the rest of us to be complacent. And, you know, that's the real lesson of the 1930s in Germany and these other places. The biggest single issue was that the rest of us were complacent. And that is really what my book is intended to cure.
Again, I'm speaking with Frederick Rich, who's the author of the new book, Just Out, Christian Nation. And in the book, after the economy tanks, McCain dies, Palin is president of the United States, and they introduce this authoritarian law called the Blessing. And of course, they also use digital technology known as the Purity Web. So just give us an idea of the way your novel, Christian Nation, portrays the methodology by which this friendly fascist, Christian fascism takes over America.
You have not only the Depression, Ian, but and I don't want to give away everything in the book, but right. There is also another deeply traumatic national incident which helps pave the way and enables the Palin administration in the book to introduce martial law. The Blessing, it's very interesting how I created the Blessing. It's basically a compilation of the political and legal agenda of the Christian right over the last 20 years on topics having to do with the family, education, religion in the public sphere, the role of women, who should be allowed to be teachers. As you know, they don't approve of homosexuals in the school. There's a move that to simply presume all non-married teachers over a certain age to be homosexual. Basically, I didn't have to make it up, Ian. All I had to do was compile it. And of course, one of the problems also is that much of this agenda has appeared in actual legislation that was tabled not only in the states but in the federal Congress during the middle of the first decade of this century. There was a piece of legislation called the Constitution Restoration Act, which basically never passed the U.S. Congress but received hundreds of votes, plurality in the Congress, which seeks to deny the federal courts jurisdiction over matters having to do with church and state. The vision that I paint in the book, although it's obviously speculative fiction, it is based almost entirely on the actual stated agenda of a broad spectrum of the Christian far right, together with legislative tools that they've already developed tried out. So it didn't take a good deal of speculation. And finally, Ian, you ask about the tools. I wrote the book before our current understanding of what the federal government was doing today in terms of internet surveillance. I basically took existing technologies that are used by authoritarian, in many cases religious authoritarian governments in Saudi Arabia, Iran, China, technologies that already exist, and simply adapted them to the purposes of the Christian fundamentalists here. I mean, almost all of us from the time we get up to the time we get to work are on some kind of camera. Most of those cameras are web-enabled. And in Saudi Arabia today, computers are able to look at those cameras and track your behavior. They can, for example, tell if two people are engaged in public displays of affection, which is illegal, as you may know, in Saudi Arabia.
Illegal here in the United States. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Frederick Rich, but I thank you so much for your novel. It's really an extraordinary read, and it's very plausible in the worst possible sense. But I thank you so much for it.
Ian, thanks for your interest and thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Frederick Rich, who's a partner with a law firm based in New York. He's studied at Princeton University, King's College, Cambridge, and the University of Virginia. And his latest book, not just out, is the novel Christian Nation. And again, I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another background briefing. Bye for now.